Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity, the sting of systemic racism, a climate in crisis, America's role in the world. Any one of these would be enough to challenge us in profound ways. But the fact is, we face them all at once.
That is how President Joe Biden laid out the challenges facing the nation and his administration in his inaugural address yesterday. Just hours later, he was at the Oval Office, pen in hand.
With the state of the nation today, there's no time to waste. Get to work immediately.
Biden signed a stack of 17 executive orders.
Some of the executive actions I'm going to be signing today are going to help change the course of the COVID crisis, and we're going to combat climate change in a way that we haven't done so far, and advance racial equity and support other underserved communities. We're going to rebuild our economy as well. And these are just all starting points.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point, and 17 executive orders on day one, from pandemic response and mask mandates and repealing the Trump administration's Muslim ban, bringing an end to a policy that also began its life as one of the earliest executive orders in the Trump administration. So, yes, President Biden is indeed getting to work. But there's also the fact that executive orders are high-profile actions without the permanence of legislation. So we're going to talk about Biden's executive orders today, what they accomplish, what they do not accomplish, and what they say about early priorities in the Biden-Harris administration. And joining us to do that is Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer for the Boston Globe. She's with us from Washington. Kimberly, good to have you back.
Hi, Meghna.
Also with us is Matt Visor, a reporter for The Washington Post. He spent the last 2 years reporting on the Biden campaign and transition, and now he is part of the Post's White House team. Matt, welcome back to you.
Hey, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, I'd love it if the two of you could sort of put this in context for us, because many people probably saw those photographs of President Biden with a stack of executive orders on his desk in the Oval Office. And we'll talk about what they are in detail. But Kimberly, let me first turn to you. It's not unusual for presidents to walk into the Oval Office on day one put pen to paper like Biden did, is it?
No, it's not at all. And particularly when it's a new president of a different party than his predecessor, a president will come in wanting to put the stamp of his presidency on policy as early as possible and take the first possible opportunity to make good on campaign promises. So you mentioned the Muslim ban that Donald Trump campaigned on. That was one of the first policies that he put into action in an executive order. Of course, it had to go through many court challenges and change a lot before it finally stuck. But it would stand to reason that his predecessor, Democratic Joe Biden, would target that among a host of other things, really to set an agenda, to set a change. And right now, the differences on a policy level, approach in every way, there could not be a more different president in Joe Biden than there was for Donald Trump. So it makes sense that Joe Biden come in from the start and really go big right away.
Yeah. Point well taken about the profound differences here. But
yes.
But Matt, let me turn to you, because the reason why I wanted to start with this is because it's quite easy in the maelstrom that is modern day media to sort of be wowed by seeing that stack of executive orders on a president's desk. But exactly as Kimberly's saying, we have seen in the past several administrations that because executive orders don't have that permanence of actual legislation, presidents come in, they make their changes, and a lot of them have to do with undoing what the last administration did. We have this policy back pendulum that swings back and forth. So in a sense, it's entirely expected that Biden would come in and overturn some of the executive orders from the previous administration.
It is. It's expected, and you're right though, that these don't have a permanence the way that a piece of legislation would. And so if Biden is not in office 4 years from now and somebody else comes in, they could just as easily undo a lot of the things that Biden is doing with the stroke of a pen. I would say, though, that what struck me yesterday is how quickly and broadly that Biden's directives were. He signed 17 different directives. By contrast, Trump, when he came in 4 years ago, signed two on his first day. Obama also signed two on his first day in 2009. And so Biden is getting off to a much more aggressive pace, I think. But it in a sense is turning the government and turning American policy back to what it was exactly 4 years ago at this time. So there is not yet a broad shift, but it is kind of a, I don't know, the pendulum is probably the right term, where you're just swinging back and forth. And so you're sort of back to American policy as it existed before Trump came into office.
Yeah, so we'll talk a little bit later about the why presidents tend to first go for executive orders versus the long, hard slog of legislation. But I just wanted to sort of put Biden's actions yesterday in context, while also not underplaying the significance of the executive orders, because they do function as policy, right? I mean, the Trump administration's so-called Muslim ban that we just talked about, it had a major impact, right, on people who sought to come to this country. So these orders do have an effect, because they direct the executive branch on how to operate. So with that in mind, let's talk a little bit more detail about the COVID area or the COVID bucket of executive orders that Biden signed yesterday. First of all, he signed an executive order for the World Health for the United States to rejoin the World Health Organization. And we spoke with Saskia Popescu, infectious disease epidemiologist and professor at George Mason University, about the significance of that executive order.
There was a lot of unfair criticism, I think, of the WHO from the Trump administration. Really is almost a scapegoat for some of that administration's own failures. And really, the WHO is about diplomacy and consensus. It's not about establishing force and making this a priority. Rejoining the WHO and supporting them really, I think, emphasizes that this pandemic is a global issue and we have partnerships that are so crucial in responding to it. So I really like this, and not only the global health aspect of it, but that it signals that we are so committed to public health and science.
So Kimberly Atkins, there are a lot of really functionally important reasons for the United States to be signaling that it's going to be part of a global pandemic response here. But also, I think there's just the signaling of the Biden administration to the global community about the United States being willing to be a partner on international issues. So your response to that executive order?
Yeah, I think both of those things are exactly right. I mean, of course, the pandemic is worldwide. That's the definition of a pandemic. And so the United States must work with other countries in order to get ahead and stamp out this virus. And in this case, this is an area, COVID response is an area where executive actions can be really effective, because hopefully they don't have to be lasting for administration to administration. A lot of the things, including rejoining the WHO, which hopefully that does stand, but a lot of these things are meant to operate quickly and provide quick relief. You know, the extending of the moratorium on evictions and student loan payments, mm-hmm. that's meant to keep people in their homes and on their feet right now, and ordering urging people to wear masks for 100 days and requiring masks in federal buildings. Those are things that are meant to be short term. It's perfect for the type of executive action rather than waiting for that long slog of legislation. And just another point I want to make, what we were talking about earlier about how executive orders aren't really lasting. Sometimes they can be, Meghna. I mean, think about DACA. Mm-hmm. President Obama put DACA into place, and Donald Trump spent 4 years challenging it. And Republicans spent 4 years challenging it, trying to throw it out. And Donald Trump tried to throw it out, and he couldn't. The Supreme Court said he did it wrong. So sometimes these These actions can have staying power. And now that gives President Biden a chance to codify DACA in legislation while taking short-term action, directing agency heads to continue to implement it. So it's not always just a fleeting bit of policy. Executive actions can be really, really important.
Oh, you brought up DACA. I was going to hold that for later in the show.
Sorry.
Because I think this is one area which maybe you and I might see things a little differently. So, but I want to give, I promise I will come back to that, okay? Okay. But I want to give Matt a chance to chime in here on the COVID-related executive orders. I mean, let's talk for a second about the mask mandate. Because again, I think this is the perfect example, as Kimberly was saying, it's something that a president can do. But of course, Biden has chosen to limit that mask mandate to federal buildings, for example, because, I mean, his administration knows that going much beyond that, an executive order would almost certainly fall to legal challenges. So we're seeing both sort of what a president can do and the limits of an EO as well, Matt.
Yeah, and this was a subject that Biden, you know, kind of took a couple different stances on during the campaign trail. At certain points, he talked about being willing to take that challenge and to have a national mask mandate, which, as you point out, would be the subject of some legal challenges and prolong that from being in place. So instead, they did what they're on firmer legal ground to do, which is to have a mask mandate on federal property and on interstate travel. So that's what Biden did immediately, with his executive powers. And the other thing, as we sort of talk about impacts, the World Health Organization this morning had a meeting. Dr. Fauci had an immediate impact. He had to get up at 4 a.m. to join that meeting. So the United States is back as of this morning engaged in those discussions because of that paperwork that President Biden signed yesterday after taking office. So I do think that there are some real implications, and they do provide us a sort of a window into what Biden is trying to do immediately. And we're going to hear more from him throughout today as he talks more about the pandemic response and uses additional executive powers to sign other executive orders today.
Well, we'll talk more when we come back about what that first slew of executive orders says about the direction that the Biden-Harris administration seeks to go. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about day one of the Biden-Harris administration. And here's what On Point listener Tina Horn from Putney, Vermont, told us she'd like to see the administration address early on.
Student debt right now needs to be at race, and then we need to move forward with finding ways to make sure that we make education a commons, and it's a right. It's not a privilege, and it shouldn't cost like it does now, and it shouldn't be privatized.
And here's Andrew from Newburyport, Massachusetts, on his early priorities.
The things that I would like to see the Biden-Harris administration do right away, day one, is work together across the aisle, to not be partisan, to not push Democratic ideals at the alienation of the members on the other side of the aisle.
I'm joined today by Kimberly Atkins. She's senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe with us from Washington. Matt Visor is also with us as well. He's White House reporter for the Washington Post. And Matt, let me just briefly ask you to the point that listener Andrew there made about bipartisanship and not risking alienation of members on the other side of the aisle from the Biden administration. Do you see, was that a concern or a thought that you saw evident in these first 17 executive orders signed by the president yesterday?
I feel like not so much in the executive orders. I mean, I think that the executive orders were sort of a clear statement of departure from President Trump. Almost all of them were sort of veering off in a completely different direction from where Trump had headed. I think to the listener's point, that's the next battle for Biden, I think, is trying to figure out legislation where he can work with members of Congress on. And I think that's going to dictate much of what Biden does in his first 100 days. He's kind of using these first 10 days to do a lot of executive actions and to sort of signal his administration's priorities. But the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package, which needs congressional approval, is going to be the next kind of major battle and the first test, really, of Biden's message of unity that he focused on in his inaugural address, and whether there can be any sort of bipartisanship achieved through that. And there are huge questions on that. There's a lot of opposition forming already among Republicans to some of the legislative priorities that President Biden is planning to pursue.
Yeah. Kimberly, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, listen, executive orders don't have to be bipartisan by nature of what they are. They're meant to establish the priorities of an administration. And every administration comes in and uses that tool in order to do that. So, but that being said, the policies that Joe Biden focused on with these early executive actions should be things that I think citizens would hope would have bipartisan support. We should want a clear and aggressive focus on battling the COVID pandemic and that immediate work. We should want policies that protect against discrimination in all forms. We should want the census to provide an accurate count so that a proper apportionment can be done of legislative districts. These are things that don't have to be polarized. They often are, but they shouldn't have to be. But just an executive order isn't meant to be bipartisan. It's meant to be a clear recitation of the policies of a certain administration.
And as far as I can tell, unlike many of the Trump administration's early executive orders, there aren't lawsuits teed up to push back against what Biden signed yesterday. I mean, Kimberly or Matt, do you know of any lawsuits thus far?
No,
well, it's been a day.
It didn't even take a day for some of the Trump administration's executive orders, though.
I think one thing to point out, though, here is none of these executive orders are truly a surprise. I mean, these are all things that Joe Biden made a centerpiece of a campaign in which he won the presidency. He was pretty upfront about getting back into the Paris Climate Accords, rescinding the orders to get out of the World Health Organization, ending the Muslim ban. All of these things are things that were a part of Biden's regular campaign message and a winning campaign message. So, I mean, I do think executive orders are things that a president is doing, but he also has a mandate to do them. So I think we're still a deeply divided country and a deeply polarized one. But I'm not all that surprised at Biden's first actions, because these are the things that he said that he was going to do on day one.
Well, Matt and Kimberly, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring Barbara Perry into the conversation. She's director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center, co-director of the University of Virginia's Presidential Oral History Program, and author of many books as well, including 42, Inside the Presidency of Bill Clinton, and 41, Inside the Presidency of George H.W. Bush. Barbara Perry, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
So you heard Kimberly and Matt remind us correctly that a day one or a week one full of executive orders is not out of the ordinary at all for a new president. But I'm wondering if you, as you look across maybe the broader swath of U.S. history, are the types of executive orders that Biden signed yesterday, are they reminiscent of any other period or any other president you might think of?
Well, yes. What comes to mind initially is FDR facing a challenge, I would say, as great as, if not greater than, what President Biden now faces. And that is, of course, the depths of the Great Depression that when FDR took office in 1933 had already been underway since the stock market collapsed in 1929. 25% of Americans out of work, people homeless, in bread lines, a climate disaster in the Middle West with the Dust Bowl. So even if people still owned their farms, they were blowing away. The topsoil was blowing away due to erosion. So the very first thing he did by executive order was declare the so-called bank holiday, which if people watched over Christmas, It's a Wonderful Life. It was a savings and loan that George Bailey had in his family. But people talked about the run on the bank. People were drawing out their savings. So there was this bank holiday closing the banks. And also, don't ask me to explain the gold standard, but it also had something to do with gold that was in the banks. But that was the very first executive order that he promulgated. And I think Joe Biden is in a similar situation where we're facing multiple crises, and he needs to have, as FDR said in his inaugural address, Americans want action, and action we will give them.
And so then that action, though, in terms of the executive order, I think Matt was making this point a little earlier, for it to have the kind of permanence that these major structural challenges require, it needs to be followed up with, layered on with legislation. And that's where the rubber really meets the road, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And so then what does FDR do but begin the New Deal? And the New Deal is both a combination of executive orders, but primarily legislation. And he had massive majorities in the House and the Senate on the Democratic Party side. So he was able to push through major pieces of legislation that constituted the New Deal to the point of that first 100 days that we now all talk about, the president's legislative agenda in the first 100 days. That really comes from the FDR period. Now, interestingly enough, just as soon as that legislation would get passed, it would be challenged, and particularly because it was economic regulation. Conservative business people would start the process of challenging it in the courts, and there was a conservative majority on the court at that time, and they struck down a total of about 13 pieces of New Deal legislation.
They struck down 13 pieces of New Deal legislation.
Yes, they did.
Ah, okay. Well, just so sticking with issues of the economy for a second more, Barbara, in terms of more modern presidencies, did we see, I honestly just can't remember, shame on me, but like President Obama used executive orders when he first came into office following the 08 financial crisis. I don't know if even earlier in the late 90s or in the early 90s, did Bill Clinton do the same thing?
Well, I think for both of those presidents, again, coming into office with economic, certainly for Barack Obama, another economic collapse to the point of seizing up of the financial system. And we in our oral history, you mentioned that I co-chair the oral history program here for our presidents. And yes, indeed, we talked to people from the Obama and the Bush administration, but particularly Bush 43, because it was on their watch that the economy was collapsing. But it wasn't just that the economy was collapsing, the financial system was collapsing. And we were just within a day or two of it seizing up in this country and therefore seizing up around the world. So yes, there was this effort of emergency situation, but also people remember TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, to get that through Congress. So I think for both Clinton and Obama, Clinton was facing not a collapse of the economy, but certainly a downturn and a terrible recession that helped him to get elected to do something about it. He had already met in Little Rock before he was inaugurated with a panel of economists to get a sense of what kinds of policies they needed, both immediately through executive orders and also for the longer run through Congress.
Oh, okay. Fascinating. Kimberly, thanks for listening along. Did you have any responses to what Barbara's saying?
Well, I mean, I think we're seeing in real time when we're looking at the policies that Joe Biden is laying out, that very responsiveness to the moment, obviously with the pandemic, but also with the economic response that he is having to try to push forward, both with executive order and with laying out his legislative agenda, responding to the economic impact of the pandemic, which is what on the trail people, voters, were most concerned about, right? And he's also being very responsive to, for example, civil rights issues after a year where people were crying out for racial justice. His policies are reflecting that too. So in that sense, it's that same reflection, not only of his own priorities, as Matt rightly said, that he has been laying out all along, but also having that responsiveness to the moment, to this time in history, you know, even in his address speaking about white supremacy. I think you're going to continue to see that in his policies as he lays them out.
Mm. Matt, what do you think?
I mean, I also think we're in the midst of kind of just a head-snapping turn between two different presidents. With George W. Bush to Obama or Clinton to Bush, I mean, they had different policies, clearly. They had different approaches and different political philosophies. But I think, you know, the transition from Obama to Trump and now Trump to Biden, there's just been huge differences in policy approaches and an increased appetite for executive orders. So I think that's a little bit of what we're seeing here with Biden so quickly undoing what Trump so quickly undid of Obama's. And so I feel like we're in kind of a little bit of a unique moment here where there's just like an abrupt back and forth,
right,
as opposed to other presidents and other transitions have been a little bit more gradual, it seems, than this one.
So I think one of the perfect examples of that are the executive orders that Biden signed in relation to the environment, right? One of them was canceling the Keystone XL pipeline and directing environmental agencies to reverse more than 100 actions from the Trump administration regarding the environment. So obviously a reversal there from the previous administration. And President Biden signed an executive order rejoining the Paris Climate Accord. So about that one, we spoke with Rachel Cletus, policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And she told us what she believes the significance of that executive order is.
The climate crisis is a global crisis, and we've always known that the pathway to solutions lies through global cooperation, through raising the level of ambition from particularly countries that are major emitters of carbon emissions, like the United States, who have a unique responsibility to sharply curtail their emissions, as well as provide funding for developing countries that are facing the brunt of some of these terrible climate impacts. So this is not a problem that any individual nation can solve on its own.
Cletus then added that she sees President Biden's executive actions as a good first sign, but that much more will need to happen.
We now have a clear early signal from the Biden administration that they will use their full power to advance climate action and do so in an equitable and just way. But we also need Congress to step up, because really, to fulfill the full breadth of our climate ambition, we will need legislation from Congress, durable actions at the national level that go beyond the term of any one president. But we're talking about a multi-year effort here.
That's Rachel Cletus, policy director with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. So, Barbara Perry, is that particular executive order one in which there maybe isn't that much tension between substance and symbolism, because rejoining the Paris Climate Accord does actually require the United States then to make certain changes regarding climate policy?
Well, I think, yes, it is both symbolic, as we've been saying, of the promises made in the campaign by Joe Biden. So he wants to show that he is going to make good, as he had said on day one, he's going to make good on the promises on the campaign trail. So he is doing that. But yes, the content and the substance become very important. And that's where, as we've been saying, the rubber hits the road, in that you have, and I think this goes back to his inaugural address yesterday in terms of facts and how people see reality. And because climate is one of those where conservatives, and particularly the extreme conservatives, don't even think there's a climate problem. Or more moderate conservatives will say, yes, the climate is changing, but it doesn't have anything to do with human behavior. So that is where there's going to be this division that is going to face the Biden administration if they try to get anything through Congress.
A division based on truths. I mean, as Biden repeatedly emphasized in his inaugural address yesterday, Barbara, that, I mean, we can talk a lot about executive orders, and we are, and I'm glad that we are, but you just got us down to some fundamentals. In a sense, it almost doesn't really even matter what President Biden signs. We still have these basic divisions over actual facts and truths.
Right, and I think that to Matt's previous point, that is exactly where we are, in that's why this seems so head-snapping, as he said. It's a really good metaphor for what has happened from Obama to Trump and now Trump to Biden, is that it seems to me for Obama and Biden, and even for conservative presidents prior to that, we could at least agree on a set of facts, and then there could be differences over policy about how to deal with those facts. We did an oral history of Senator Ted Kennedy, and one of the things he said towards the end of his life in our oral history about this change in reality, he said it used to be the difference that he noted in Congress with his colleagues, but also people testifying before it, was that you would have a difference between the glass being half empty and half full. Now he said people don't even agree that there's a glass on the table.
Well, Barbara Perry, Matt Visor, and Kimberly Atkins stand by. We'll talk a lot more about several other executive orders that President Biden signed yesterday, specifically on immigration, when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk with several historians about how they view the course of this historic week, and in fact, the month overall that began early with an insurrection at the Capitol, then an impeachment, and then an inauguration. That was just 3 Wednesdays in a row in January. So we want to know how you've been looking across this month, or even the events of this week. What does this nation look like to you now? Where would you like it to go next? 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Leave us a message for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the 17 executive orders that President Biden signed yesterday in the Oval Office, mere hours after the inauguration. I'm joined today by Matt Visor, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Barbara Perry is also with us. She's director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. And Kimberly Atkins is with us as well. She's senior opinion writer at the Boston Globe. Now, among those 17 EOs, there were 5 related to immigration, everything from extending deferrals of deportation for some people in the United States, halting construction on the border wall, undoing some expansion of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement policies within the United States, ending the so-called Muslim ban, and fortifying the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. So let's talk about that one a little bit more. Carlos Ruiz Martinez is a PhD student in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Iowa, and he's lived in the U.S. since he was in the first grade. But it wasn't until college that President Obama created the DACA policy via an executive order, which allowed Carlos to then work as a teacher after he graduated and to consider going to graduate school. And then, as we've discussed, soon after President Trump's inauguration, Carlos thought that everything for him could quickly change.
There's a lot of anxiety, and I remember refreshing my phone, you know, at every moment that I could for news of, you know, an executive order that would rescind DACA, clicking on CNN, every news source, refreshing Twitter to see when that executive order would come. Knowing that that was looming was pretty difficult. It was early weeks and months. The day that DACA was rescinded was the first week, my first week of graduate school. At that point, as soon as DACA was rescinded, I then had like a sort of a ticking clock, right, of my work permit. And renewing it was not going to be a possibility for me, right? So I didn't know if I was going to be able to complete that master's program or not, because, again, it was a work permit that allowed me to sort of get funding through the university. One of the things I went through my mind is like perhaps going back to Mexico makes sense. I don't necessarily, you know, want to continue to be living with such, like I said, the anxiety of checking my phone all of the time to see what, you know, my future would look like. That's not a healthy way to live. Biden's inauguration is a sigh of relief. However, I want to be very clear that I'm not necessarily optimistic. You know, we have to remember that Biden was part of the Obama administration, which separated thousands of families. Issues of immigration today and historically are wrapped up in with years and years of colonialism and expansion and American imperialism. And I don't know that, you know, immigration reform bills under the Biden administration will come even close to accounting for that. I am hopeful that some good things can happen. I am not necessarily optimistic that we will see radical change.
That's Carlos Ruiz Martinez, a PhD student in religious studies at the University of Iowa. Okay, Kimberly, so here we've come back around to DACA. And the reason why I wanted to spend a considerable amount of time on it is because I do think, I take your point from earlier that initially signed by President Obama and President Trump failed to, in his efforts to rescind DACA. So it has had some staying power. But on the other hand, we also saw this very policy end up being a political football in those similarly failed attempts to achieve comprehensive immigration reform in the early years of the Trump administration. So DACA recipients, by virtue of this being an executive order and never having it thus far made into actual legislation, have been living on the razor's edge since, you know, for more than a decade now. It's not, it does not have the permanence that law would bring.
So I didn't in any way mean to imply that those eligible to participate in DACA have not had a difficult road to hoe. I was just making the statement that an executive order, we were speaking about these executive orders like it's a stroke of a pen in one administration and then the next person can simply come in and stroke it and it goes away. Donald Trump tried to make DACA go away for 4 years and he couldn't. But in the process of attacking it, obviously it left people like Carlos in a terrible position. New applicants could not sign up for DACA. That has only been able to happen again in the last couple of months because of a court order. So yes, it has been a very tumultuous road for those, and I feel for people like Carlos. But at the same time, DACA still exists, despite the fact that we've had a whole administration that tried to kill it, and now you have a new administration that has directed, Joe Biden has directed the leader of agencies to try to protect it and continue to implement it. Now, that is probably the least powerful tool that he can possibly use, it really doesn't mean anything except him signaling, hey, I want DACA to stay and we're going to fight for it. There will still be challenges. The Supreme Court has yet to consider DACA on its merits. It has only looked at procedural issues, and that's what kept it in place all this time. So until it becomes law, the Supreme Court can anytime decide to take it up on the merits and find that it's unconstitutional and strike the whole thing down. So it is perilous, but so has immigration policy always been. I mean, you bring up the beginning of the Trump administration where Donald Trump actually came to the table and expressed some support for DACA, just said he wanted to stop what Obama did and do something else. And it was at the final hour when there was almost an agreement on some sort of immigration reform that would include DACA that his own administration, actually his chief of staff, John Kelly, stepped in and told him, no, this will, your base is going to hate this. You cannot do this. And the White House pulled out of that deal.
Indeed, he moved the goalposts quite a bit in that whole process.
Yes, he did. So immigration reform is probably the toughest policy that exists in Washington, and I don't see it getting any easier.
Matt, your thoughts?
I think as we talk about immigration, we were just talking about climate change. I think back to past attempts at some of this. It was a decade ago that John Kerry pursued a pretty ambitious climate piece of legislation that died in the Senate. It was 2013 when there was a gang of eight in the Senate that pursued comprehensive immigration reform, which passed the Senate but never got a vote in the House. These problems are not new. And it introduces a little bit of skepticism into whether Joe Biden, in a Senate and a Congress that's only gotten more polarized, can pass these kind of sweeping pieces of legislation. The immigration bill that he's filed is going to be a tough one, you know, for this Senate to pass. And as Barbara and the callers were making a point earlier in the program about getting back into the Paris climate deal, you still need to pass legislation. You still need to do actions in order to live up to the standards of that climate deal. And that is going to require legislation and more work on Biden's part to pass new standards. And you know, given the recent history in Congress in doing things that require bipartisanship and sweeping pieces of legislation, they have not been successful in the past decade or more.
Right. So on that note, Barbara, I'm going to come to you in a second, but I want to hear for a moment from J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, a staff attorney at the University of California Davis School of Law's Immigration Clinic. We talked to him yesterday, and he said he's gratified by the language in Biden's proposed immigration legislation. But, you know, exactly about what you're saying, Matt, about how do you achieve bipartisan consensus over these sweeping proposals, Sepulveda said he wondered what it would look like after negotiations in Congress.
What happened a lot when Biden was vice president under the Obama administration is there was always this rhetoric about a nation of immigrants, and they would do some great things like DACA. But then there was always this focus on immigration enforcement. They would always say, you know, this is to bring Republicans to the table to negotiate on immigration reform, and we have to be tough on crime or criminals. And it was always so broad that to see the Biden administration at least starting out say, no, we're just going to focus on immigration reform and not try and be heavy on enforcement right away is really heartening to see.
That's J.J. Mulligan Sepulveda, staff attorney at the University of California Davis Law School Immigration Clinic. Barbara Perry, did you want to respond to that?
Well, I think that this theme is that most people realize that there has to be reform. There has to be immigration reform. And yet, because of this polarization, because of these two different realities, particularly of the bases of both parties, that it is difficult, as Matt said, to try to do anything that is sweeping, any kind of sweeping immigration legislation such as there was in the 1965 Immigration Act signed by Lyndon Johnson right next to the Statue of Liberty. to undo the terribly discriminatory legislation of the 1920s. It's just hard to believe that we could get to that point. But my view is, similarly to others, that if anybody can do this or at least get incremental change by crossing the aisle, it is Joe Biden, because of his moderation, because of his knowing the system, and because of his knowing many of these personalities on the Hill.
I'm going to offer myself up as the curmudgeon at the table here about executive orders in general, and say that I find them to be kind of a strange tool, right? I mean, for all the reasons that we've talked about, I get it. It's a way to institute quick change. It's an effective way for administration to lay out its priorities, to signal those priorities, and actually have effect on policy. But I also wonder, I mean, to the point that we're all making here, big structural challenges require big structural change via legislation. Barbara, do executive orders make that more difficult because it might make it easier to kick the can down the road rather than coming to the table and hashing out bipartisan solutions over things like immigration?
Well, that's an interesting point, Meghna. I hadn't really quite thought of it that way, but I'll say a couple things. One is that we have DACA via the Obama administration because they couldn't get the comprehensive legislation through the Congress. So it depends on, are you willing to take the half loaf or the quarter loaf if you can't get the whole loaf of bread? Or just say, if I can't get the whole loaf, I'm not going to try for anything. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind in this polarized time. The second is the concept of prerogative power, particularly on issues of emergency like COVID, that this is where I think executive orders particularly play a role, in addition to the compromise and the half loaf, is that when we have true emergencies, as we do now, there is this concept of prerogative power that the executive does have the ability to act with dispatch and urgency. And so I think they do play an important role there as well.
Good point. And also, it has been made more difficult, Matt and Kimberly, as you've all been saying, by the profound polarization, right, in American politics, that even just coming to the table in Congress, members of Congress coming to the table, feels like a virtual impossibility. So that is something, Kimberly, that Joe Biden is going to have to contend with, like, starting now.
Yes, he will. And look, I personally don't think that executive orders somehow impede legislation or make it harder to set those priorities. These are two, the executive branch and the legislative branch, since the beginning of our nation, have been two separate co-equal bodies of the government. Both can and should operate at the same time. And the executive, the president as the head of the executive, has the right to, with his executive orders, set the policy priorities for federal agencies, which is essentially what these executive orders do. I mean, one reason why the mask mandate is only for federal buildings is because that's what Joe Biden has the power to do. Mm-hmm. He can ask, he can urge, and he is urging all Americans for at least 100 days just to wear masks when they leave their homes. But other than that, the power, his executive power, goes to agencies. So I think they can and should operate in conjunction with each other. Yes, partisanship is going to make all of this more difficult, but I get really frustrated and tired of people making excuses for government not being responsive and government not being efficient. It always can be. The reason that it's not is because the people in it are choosing not to do it. And I think all of those people in government, whether you're a member of Congress, whether you're in the executive, whether you're a judge in the judiciary, you have an obligation to do your job well. And if politics is keeping you from doing that, that's the problem.
Kimberly, if we were on a Zoom call right now, I'd be giving you that hand clappy emoji, okay? I am right there with you. Matt, we've just got a minute left to go in the show. You're reporting on the White House now, on the Biden White House for the Washington Post. Can you just give me a glimpse into what you're going to be keeping your eye on in the next coming days or this first week here?
What I think is so interesting in this discussion is Biden as he searches for executive powers. He is a man of the Senate. He spent 36 years there, more than almost anyone in history, and spent time with a reason to be skeptical of executive powers. And so I think his first instincts here are legislation. It's searching for compromise. But there are voices in the party and among his advisors telling him to be bold on executive actions as well if those deals don't come, to consider changing the rules of the Senate and maybe eliminating the filibuster, which opens up a whole nother can of worms. Mm. So I think in these first days and weeks, we're getting a sense on Biden and sort of his approach to the executive powers that he now has.
Matt Visor, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for being with us, Matt.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Atkins, senior opinion writer at The Boston Globe. Kimberly, always great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
And Barbara Perry, director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Absolutely fascinating to have you with us, Barbara. Thank you.
My pleasure, Magna.
This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.